I was one of the Native American children, adopted at birth and removed from our country's Indian reservation system. I was raised in a small middle-class farming community, but was never told of my true American Indian heritage. It was still taboo back in those early days. The years passed, and in 1987, I lost both parents. While going through their personal belongings, my wife discovered my adoption papers and she began a search. 5 years later, I was reunited with my biological Lakota family living on the Lower Brule Sioux Indian Reservation of South Dakota. I am a son of two mothers and a product of two worlds that had collided, but I have an equal amount of love and pride for both. I'm Paul LaRush, and the stories you are about to see are an attempt to share this true American story of a hidden heritage.
During the course of a lifetime, we all have mentors and role models, those who give us great hope and inspiration. It seems fair to say that somewhere in their silent intervention, our destiny and potential hangs in the balance. One particular year when times were tough, I had a chance encounter, what some might call good timing and others might call synchronicity. While performing on the small stage at Mount Rushmore, Park Superintendent Gerard Baker stopped by to say hello. Gerard is one of the first Native American National Park superintendents and the first at Mount Rushmore. Upon first meeting, he was complimentary of our music, but as time passed, I came to realize the full magnitude of the story I was about to hear. To say it changed my life would be an understatement.
Welcome to this episode of Hidden Heritage. Today we're going to travel to the southwest corner of South Dakota and visit one of our country's most beautiful national monuments, Mount Rushmore. Work began on Mount Rushmore in 1927 and it took 14 years to complete. But there's a lot more to the story than the four phases that dominate the side of the mountain. In earlier times, the Black Hills and the Mount Rushmore area were considered the holy land and the sacred site of the Great Sioux Nation. And to this day, there's still many that consider that area to be a sacred site. It's complicated by the fact that in earlier days, with the discovery of gold, it led to a lot of conflict and trials and tribulations between the cultures. Well, they say that time heals a lot of wounds. And there's nobody that understands that better than Gerard Baker, a member of the Mandan Hidatsa tribe of North Dakota. Gerard is the first Native American National Park superintendent of Mount Rushmore. Recently, I had a chance to meet with Gerard and we sat down and had a wonderful talk. His story was overwhelming.
Berthel Indian Reservation, and that's the home of the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara. My father's a Mandan, my mother's a Hidatsa, and I grew up, as I tell people, I'm the first generation to be born outside of the garrison, outside of our beautiful garrison reservoir. I had to be a rancher, so we went to what we call the western side of McKenzie County on the Fort Brother Reservation, which is in the western part of North Dakota. Set up a ranch there, and I'm very proud of my early days because my early days, we had no running water, we had no electricity, and which means that we were every day and every night was filled with stories, was filled with the old timers coming to our house and visiting us. So that's how I grew up. Then I went to the boarding schools like a lot of us did back in those days. And so I spent 4 years in Catholic boarding school and got a scholarship to play basketball in college. I went to Bassolis College. And that's where I first started learning about the National Park Service. And biggest city in the area. Went there and came back all excited that night because he was telling us about the place he went to. It turned out the place he went to was Theodore Roosevelt National Park, the North Unit, where eventually I became a district ranger in charge of that place. He came back and he started telling stories about this wonderful park that he saw and this guy they called a park ranger. And the way he described him, to me as a little boy, this guy was 10 feet tall and wore this huge hat and took care of the wilderness. Two disappointments that day. First one was the guy wasn't 10 feet tall. He didn't drive his great big car with bubble lights on it, which in the old days was a patrol cars. He didn't have this 10-gallon hat. He was just like you and I. And that was my first disappointment. My second disappointment was watching him get on that bronc and seeing him get thrown over a 10-foot high fence. So those are my two disappointments. What happened with me as far as living on a reservation is that, believe it or not, I wanted to stay there. I wanted to, not knowing about the cycle, I seen that. I seen a lot of relatives having troubles making the adjustment from the days when we were pretty much free in river bottoms to when the government stopped us and dammed our reservation and moved us out to lands that we couldn't farm anymore. And it took away all of our freedoms, and we replaced that by alcohol, which was really too bad. We replaced that by, we had no jobs. There was no jobs to be held there. And so my dad made a very good conscious decision to move on as far as a rancher. We had no money, but we weren't poor. We were extremely rich in culture. We were extremely rich in tradition. I was extremely fortunate to have the elders there because my father was not only a tribal judge, he was a leader, if you will, in almost in the medicine way, meaning that a lot of people would bring their kids over to have him get counseled by my father. And so I grew up in that, and I grew up with the understanding, both from my parents and from our clan relatives. I belong to the Apukiwaka clan, which means the low-cap clan. And so I had a lot of clan grandparents there all the time, giving us encouragement as they would. And as I tell people, I really believe that what I experienced as a young kid was the last remaining activities, if you will, coming from a village tribe, because we were agricultural, we lived in earth lodges, we had extended families traditionally that would have 30-some people in our lodge, always being counseled, always being talked to by the elders. And myself and my siblings had that when we were young coming up. And so even though I still want to stay there, I didn't want to go anyplace. I love the reservation. I want to be there. I want to ranch. It was my father and mother and my clan grandfathers and mothers that kept telling us all the time the need to live in both worlds. We have to live in both worlds in order to survive. The other choice is to be proud of who you are. And as my grandfather would say over and over again, as my father would say over and over again, it's time to be that warrior again, because we lost that warriorness for a while. And I really believe we did that. Some kept it, but it was attempted to be driven out of us from many different angles, from government angles, from academic, from religions, even organized religions. And so we were always behind when it comes to that. And I can remember one time, you know, I did, even though I never got my flunk out letter from college, I left one college where I played basketball with a 0.000 something GPA. And I was proud of myself, and I went back home and I wanted to stay there. I said, now I can stay and be, well, one of my clan grandfathers was there, and he wouldn't talk to me for a while. He was mad, I knew that. And when he finally talked to me, he said something that hits me even to this day. He looked at me and he said, "You're." Anyway, my grandfather, he said, "That's your enemy." He called my books my enemy. And he said, "Your enemy defeated you." And that got to me, like I said, and even to this day, I still use that every day, because what we have to do, and that's what my grandfather said, and that's how I start with all this, is that we have to be warriors again. We have to adopt and adapt as warriors did in the old days, even to this day. My parents would constantly tell me, your first enemy and your worst enemy is yourself. You have to understand that, they would say. Once you understand that, then you can conquer the enemy. But it was at that point where I started reevaluating how I thought, what my process was, and understanding that I've always heard that as a young kid. Never put it together until it happened to me. And so because of that, I started understanding, yes, I can move off the reservation.
Stay with us as we follow the long, hard road of Gerard Baker, the first Native American National Park Superintendent, Mount Rushmore. In this episode, we're visiting with Gerard Baker, first Native American National Park Superintendent, Mount Rushmore. Gerard's mission is to bring all cultures into focus at the park. Mount Rushmore is a memorial that symbolizes America. And Americans should never lose sight of their cultural beginnings, says Superintendent Baker. Let's follow his journey as he enters the national park system.
As when I first got to be a law enforcement ranger at Theodore Roosevelt, I used to go there, and I was only Indian around, by the way. And I used to go on patrol, and I'd watch the interpreters speaking. And it was like there was nobody there before Theodore Roosevelt, before it became a national park. And I used to watch it all the time, and of course I was really, I was kind of shy back in those days. I had a hard time speaking in front of people. And I can remember that. I kept remember talking to myself and watching them, thinking to myself, you know, they're not telling the whole story. They're not telling the Indian story. There was Indians here, and this was our land before. And so I finally went to a chief interpreter, and I said, you know, can I do a program? So that's how I got started in interpretation. That's how I got started telling our story. And I went from there started there working there. I got my permanent job at Knife River Indian Villages, went to Fort Union Trading Post as a historian, went to Theodore Roosevelt North Unit as a district ranger, and then I got a very good promotion and went to the Forest Service for a little while, then asked to be a superintendent at Little Bighorn. What I did there was Barbara Sutier, actually Barbara Boer, who a lot of people know and respect, including myself, was the first American Indian superintendent there. I was a second. And she had a really tough time. And so when I came in, it was about the same thing. And I can remember when I first came in, I had FBI come to my office and they said, if you and your family ever want to go to town, let us know and we can go with you. And I kind of laughed at him. I thought he was joking. I said, no, I can take care of myself. He said, no, you have to understand. There's been some bad things happening here. There's been some threats already with Barbara. And I said, no, I don't need any help. I can take care of myself. And so it started that way. What I did is I started bringing into even increasing more of the Indian interpretation and the Indian way of life. Not only the scouts that were used, the Crow and the Rikara, but all the other ones who were against George Custer and defeated George Custer and his army. We're talking about the Lakota, Nakota, Dakota. We're talking about the Cheyennes. We're talking about Arapaho, a couple of people there. And we start inviting them in, and I start making contacts with them. And it was interesting because I would go up there and on Last Stand Hill, for example, and I would watch the elders come in there. And rather than gloat over the victory, 9 times out of 10, and maybe sometimes 10 times out of 10, I would especially see the old grandmas cry up there. They would look over that battlefield and they would cry. And I would go up there after they got through, and I respected them. When they sat down, I'd go sit by them, just talk about weather, whatever. And after a while, we start talking. They would notice me. They would ask what I was doing. I told them I'd be in charge, which they wouldn't believe for a long time. When they did believe, then they would open up to me. They weren't mourning even over the dead of that battlefield. They were mourning what that battle caused. It caused a change of life for the people. Almost like Lewis and Clark coming to open up the West, same thing, caused a change of life. And that's what they would mourn. It was at that time I started talking, I kept telling myself, man, people need to hear this. People need to hear that side of the story. You know, they think that we were quote unquote savages, that, you know, they didn't understand that battle was our life. They didn't understand that women were in that battle. They didn't understand that the first time Reno attacked the village, it wasn't the warriors that defended it. It was the women and the old men that attacked, that staved off the attack by Reno until the warriors came over their horses. When I left Little Bighorn Battlefield, I ended up having 7 confirmed death threats on my life and my family's life. And those are the kind of guys that, yeah, you want to rip their heads off, but you can't. You have to educate again. You go back to that patience. You go back to the education part of it. But even those kind of people, you can't educate sometimes. They're already set.
You're watching the story of Gerard Baker, the first Native American Mount Rushmore National Park superintendent.
A little over 4 years. And it got easier in some respects. It got more difficult in other respects. The easier part was that we opened up dialogue with all the different communities, Indian white communities. We had a very good cadre of National Park Service interpreters, Indian and white, working there, and the hardcores were still after me. I did everything I could possibly do, and I had to go. So I left there, and I got a job as the superintendent at Chickasaw Recreation Area in Oklahoma. Very good, the natural resource area. Had a very good time there. We had people come together with the town and Chickasaw Nation, and we built villages. We had good interpretations, so we did a lot of work with that. Then I got this call. And the call said, we know that you researched Lewis and Clark a lot. We know that you did a lot of work. They said, would you want to head up the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial and put it together for the country? It took me 2 seconds. You bet I did. Like that, and I said, here's the new superintendent of the Lewis and Clark Trail, Gerard Baker, and I stood up. And they're all smiling and kind of talking like that, and they see me there smiling, and I said, the first thing I want to tell you folks, I said, we will never celebrate Lewis and Clark. You could have heard a pin drop in that room. Everybody went deathly silent. And I can see in their faces saying, we hired the wrong guy. I can see it in their faces. And so I told them, I said, and the reason is this, folks. We won't celebrate that. We will honor a group of individuals under the direction of a president of the United States that went across this country. Yes, we'll honor that. And I said, one of my goals is to not put you on that boat with Lewis and Clark. One of my goals is to put you in the Indian village and watch that boat come around the corner and see what happens. You gotta think about that. And so when I started talking about what we were doing, what I was thinking, they agreed it was a good idea. And in one particular meeting, there was a lot of Indian people there. I was giving my philosophy about what we're gonna do with Lewis and Clark as far as looking at before Lewis and Clark, before the white man got here, during Lewis and Clark, the last 200 years and the future. Educate people as they come through your reservation. Educate people on who we are today. Educate people on our challenges. Because there's so much racism out there, there's so much misconceptions out there that we can use Lewis and Clark for our benefits. And it was excellent. We got the tribes on board. I started out with 60-some tribes talking. We ended up with 54 tribes we ended up working with coast to coast. It went really well. 4.5 years of that, I traveled all the time, getting it organized. Had a very good crew of people, very good backup from Washington, D.C. I mean, really good backup. The good friend of mine, the late, he's passed away now with cancer, the late Randy Jones was one of my best friends, if you will, that helped me. And he was in the Washington office. And of course, the directors helped me as well. And it was very, very positive. We had a good experience. I had a little bit of a heart problem. I had 5 bypasses, and I figured, well, I better settle down a little bit and not travel much anymore. So after my bypasses, and they said, would you like Mount Rushmore? That didn't take me 2 seconds. It took me 4 days to decide that because of the history of Mount Rushmore. I grew up on a reservation 5 hours from here, yet we knew what happened. We knew that the American Indians, the Lakotas, Nakotas, and Dakotas got forced out of here. And ever since I've been a kid, I've heard the negativities of that. And so when I got asked to be the superintendent here, the first ever American Indian superintendent here, it took me 4 days. And what I did is I started asking the relatives, if you will, the friends that I made throughout my career, American Indian people. A lot of them at Pine Ridge. Most of them are gone now because they were elders. Most of them are gone, unfortunately. But I start calling around to people I knew, including my own relative, and I said, what should I do? First Indian there, it's dedicated to basically white America. Bad history as far as the removal, Indian removal. They would tell me, by all means, take that job. What a place to start bringing us together as human beings. What a place to start educating our young so that they don't have to go through what we went through as adults.
Join us now for the conclusion of our talk with Gerard Baker, the first Native American Mount Rushmore National Park superintendent.
Again, we went around to reservations and we introduced everything, what we're going to do, and what I got from the people, from the traditional elders especially was, we need to tell the story up here. And I came in with the attitude, we have to tell both sides here. And what I thought is that I would get negative reaction from the public. I got just the opposite. What I got was a need and a yearning to learn about the American Indian plight here. And I can remember this. One time we took a reservation, and it was, I believe, in Lower Brule. And I came out of the meeting, and one of my staff members left. And I can see her walking by herself. And I figured, well, maybe she's not feeling well or whatever. And for me, it was an eye-opener. I didn't understand that. And she was crying. And I said, what's wrong? And she said, and this is interesting, I think. She said, I didn't realize how much feeling these people had. Even that concept, these people, of course, you can take that negative. It wasn't negative. She didn't understand us, if you will. And talking to the elders, it hit her. She understood it, and she couldn't handle it. It was really, I mean, to me, that was a very positive episode in her life. And that changed her, one of my workers. I knew we had come a long ways when I got this call from the Pine Ridge Council, tribal council, saying, hey, can we come and have a retreat there? And I knew we had come a long ways. They came in, the tribe came in, they did a retreat, the president was here, and I was so proud of that. And we're not there yet. And I think we can make an impact. And I think me as an American Indian superintendent can make an impact, especially if people understand that I wasn't given a golden platter. I had, like everybody else, I had to struggle, but it was well worth it. And I think to this day, that's where I'm at. And so when I say that in all honesty, to really look at this park, that is the best view. Those presidents are very much involved here. Their presidents are very much important here. And we'll never shy away from that. But what that comes with, it comes with culture as well. Which means that what we're promoting here is not only the American Indian culture, it's the cultures of America, what made up America. We have to be proud of who we are. I don't care if we're American Indians, if we're American Norwegians, if we're American Italians, Germans, now Vietnamese, Hispanics, African American, we can go on and on and on. That's what makes up this country. That's what I get excited about when I talk about Mount Rushmore.
After meeting Gerard Baker, I found that I agreed with many of his thoughts that it's best to choose education and cultural awareness rather than anger or guilt to accentuate the Native American culture, both in the traditional sense and in contemporary aspects. A few years after the beginning of Brule, I had an idea for a concert of reconciliation as a gesture of hope and healing between the two cultures that I was now part of. Mount Rushmore seemed the most appropriate place to hold such a concert, since it is at the very epicenter of the conflict between the white world and the Lakota world. Some people had asked me, why not Crazy Horse Mountain? And that was not passed out of disrespect, rather, the idea of a Native American gesture of reconciliation at Mount Rushmore seemed much more powerful and meaningful. I shared my idea with Gerard Baker to hold the concert at Mount Rushmore's Grand Amphitheater, and he said to me, Paul, the Great Sioux Nation wants their story told.
But everything is meant to happen. Everything has a purpose. And I think the biggest purpose up here, especially when you guys coming up, look how many people you're reaching from all over the world. I hear time and time again the reconciliation theme that you have, and that's the most beautiful theme I've ever heard. And that needs to continue.